My name is Ricky Burdett. I'm delighted to welcome you to this lecture by Sir Norman Foster. I'm the director of the city's architecture and engineering program, new development within the school, which has just started this term with 20 new master's students studying architecture, urbanism, and social science. And the whole point of this lecture and the next two public lectures which we are holding this term is very much to extend the thinking and the knowledge that we have enshrined in this new program, which is to try and help develop, in a way, new languages of bringing together issues of urban social science from the point of view of governance, from the point of view of decision making and policy making, to the issues of urban design and the making of buildings, and probably most importantly, the making of the spaces between buildings. This term, as I've said, there are three lectures. Norman will be speaking tonight about issues of the public realm and focusing also particularly on London. Richard Sennett, who's a visiting professor of sociology this term in the school, centennial professor, will be speaking at the same time next Tuesday, 10th of November, and I hope you will all be able to come to that. And then later on this term, Richard Rogers, the architect, will be speaking on the 8th of December on issues to do with urbanism and urban development. It's for an architect like me nearly bizarre to try to have to introduce Norman Foster. But it's a great pleasure in many ways because of the fact that we've worked together many years as a friend, as is Elena, his wife. And I think it's of great interest because behind the incredibly sort of slick and elegant buildings that you'll be seeing tonight and some of you may have experienced, there's an extraordinary passion and a commitment to the understanding the processes and the uses of buildings, and trying to always question why buildings are the way they are and why they might change. And I think Norman tonight, in talking about his projects, will be trying to a bit uncover some of the issues which concern an architect when designing a major public space such as Trafalgar Square or Parliament Square, or redesigning or playing around with it to a degree, or dealing with much more complicated buildings such as the British Museum or a commercial office tower. How do you actually deal with the public space both within buildings and outside? Norman was born in Manchester, set up in practice with, in fact, Richard Rogers at the time of a group of architects called Team Four. I've said this many times, Norman gets a bit embarrassed, but it's like the Spice Girls of architecture, given what sort of the way they've all been. Luckily, the Spice Girls are now four, rather than five. And then set with his partnership, which now Foster and Partners, has been responsible for a series of public buildings, including the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, Stansted Airport, the Hong Kong new airport, which opened earlier this year. But his interest really very much extends from the designing of door handles to the designing of bits of cities and new cities. And being sort of contextual, he's also responsible for the new designs for our library, just behind most of you. He's received many awards, mainly the, or most notably, shall we say, the Royal Institute of British Architects Gold Medal Award. He was knighted a few years back for his services to architecture, and last year received the Order of Merit from the Queen. Most importantly, behind all that is an ability to create extraordinarily beautiful spaces and to talk about them with, I think, enormous interest, especially, I think, to those of us who are not within the architectural and design professions. So I'd like very much to welcome Norman to speak to us for about an hour. The idea is then we will have 20 minutes, maybe half an hour of questions, and then there are drinks, and I think I'm right in saying for everyone, if we can all fit, I hope so, up on the fifth floor. So that is the plan for the evening. But would you welcome Norman Foster? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Ricky. Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Great pleasure to be here and to share some thoughts on the theme that that Ricky's talked about. Like most architects, I'm interested in creating buildings, and a part of the team that, for example, would produce a headquarters for the Hong Kong Bank seen under construction in these images here. It was Winston Churchill who said words to the effect that we shape our buildings and our buildings shape us. And I think there is a kind of image of the architect as somebody who pulls a design out of the back pocket, who sketches on the back of an envelope, and somehow that is the design process, and it happens in glorious isolation. It would actually be a wonderful world for architects if it was like that. Reality is that is far more complex. There's an extraordinary network of individuals, bodies, some of them authorized, some of them with quite free remits to pressure, to interpret. So it's a very, very complex series of procedures. It's fair to say that if you are immersed in the design of a building, then in one sense, you're concerned about the way that building works inside. And that obviously has an influence on the outside of the building. But also, simultaneously, you are thinking of the building in the public realm. And the building is a fusion of those two worlds. It's private inner world and it's public outer world, notwithstanding the fact that many buildings are public buildings. I just wanted to give some glimpses into that process with the Hong Kong Bank, seen on the Hong Kong currency, a kind of symbol of the place, a gesture at the time of its creation in the late 70s, opened in the mid-80s, as a symbol of continuity and prosperity at a time of political change in Hong Kong. Now, we ran within the building a series, within the client organization, a series of exercises to find out what was important to them about the building. A kind of game, if you like, where you would say from 0 to 20, how important is something like flexibility or communication or the efficiency of space or security or energy or the external image, to which somebody said, by the external image, do you mean the banking hall? Because for bankers, the banking hall is really part of the outside. It's the outside brought in. It is, in that sense, a public space, although it's not open 24 hours. Customer benefits, employee benefits, urban benefits, operational efficiency. Quite interesting to see the way that that ended up. External image was very high. It scored the highest. Somewhere up here, things like flexibility, space efficiency, and you can see it. The urban benefits, of course, you could say that in some ways the external image was related to the urban benefits. If you ran this exercise with the other groups that you would be dealing with and who the bank would be dependent, if you like, on you to be able to satisfy them, their rating would be totally different. So the urban benefits would be scoring massively and the hierarchy would be obviously different. So for me, that whole interest in the public realm, the way in which the individual buildings come together to make the outdoor spaces, which really a city is about, that could be a city, it could be a village. The high street is really, if you think about it, the symbol of a village. It's not the individual building. And in that sense, those outdoor spaces which shape the city and shape our lives, in turn have furniture, like inside spaces. And I've, for a long time, as long as I can remember, been interested in that. One of my favorite urban shortcuts is in Milan. It's this
Galleria, which was done in the last century and which connects the Opera House, La Scala, with the Cathedral Square. It's interesting, I still use the best image that I have of that, which I took 40 years ago as a student when I was at Manchester on a kind of study trip to Milan. This one on the right is later. So intuitively, or as a kind of reflex, I'm as a designer with my colleagues, I'm thinking about ways in which perhaps you can re-examine a building to see how it can contribute, add a dimension of urbanity, of public space, to improve the quality of life within that city. And this here is not that easy to understand, so I'll try and help the explanation. If you think of a typical office building, you walk in through the front door and you're usually confronted by a kind of solid mass. It's a central core, and it contains the lifts, the toilets, the things that drive the building. And in that kind of building, the whole footprint of the building when it comes down is private. So you have to walk around the edges of that building. Now, Hong Kong is incredibly dense. There's very, very little outdoor public space. So it's extraordinarily precious. And one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of the reasons to explore an alternative to that, by taking that solid core and pulling those to the edges so that the building became a bridge over the ground, you would then be able to walk underneath it, together with other devices to pull sunlight through reflectors down into that space. Possibility then was of expanding the space under the building, of increasing that public realm. And it's quite interesting that is the opposite of the earlier colonial model. This was the early bank which was taken down and which was the site for the new Hong Kong Bank headquarters, and it's at the head of Statue Square. When that was demolished, you can see this as a model. This is the bridge of the building, and this space flows up. You can actually see through to the street on the other side. You can see that yellow bus there. And this is not only a kind of ceremonial space, there are all kinds of events that take place under that building. It's a urban shortcut. It's also an incredibly popular picnic spot at the weekend. So then there are other dimensions in terms of, if you like, the social responsibilities that follow from an act of building. And if you take that in terms of the energy consumption in the world, 50% of the energy consumed is consumed by buildings, the remaining 50% divided between transportation and industry. So anything that could reduce that is obviously has to be good news. There is another issue which I'll come to later, and that is the polluting effect of buildings. Now, this is moving on more than 10 years to Frankfurt and another bank headquarters, which is for Commerzbank. And the diagram on the left is next to this view of the building, and you can see these interruptions up the building. They are, in actual fact, 9 four-story high gardens, indoor gardens, and they go in a sort of spiral around the edge of the building. And the three kinds, depending on the orientation, whether it's on the sunny side or the shadow side, one's a North American, one's Mediterranean, the other is Asian. They're all part of the microclimate of the building, which encourages the movement of air through. Now, obviously, in a high-rise building where you get strong winds, you can't use the benefits of natural ventilation all the time, but for more than 60% of the time you can do. And so the building's control system controls the climate, but allows the individual and also the gardens, which break down the scale of the space. So it's a series of kind of villages, one above the other. Now, this, I cannot separate this from, if you like, a particular personal passion, and a passion that's, again, shared with my colleagues in our studio. I cannot separate that passion for that concern with the political climate of the city. And Frankfurt is very special. Germany is very special in that. I would say that it's, without doubt, the most advanced country in terms of its sensitivity to issues of ecology. And Frankfurt, in particular, is a green city with a very strong green administration. It certainly was at the time of the realization of this building. So, again, this grew very much out of a dialogue with the city at a political level, and also with the bank at a more private level. The distinction between the public and the private, you can incidentally see those gardens here. You see the diagram on the left, the way that they relate to air movement. In that sense, there is a kind of ordering of space from the private individual office down to the way that this provides a group space and is part of the social structure of the company. And then the way, as you come down to the ground, the way that that relates to the community of the city. And there are obviously, in a city, some places which really are private. I mean, you can't get past the security barrier unless you work there or you have a legitimate reason to penetrate. There are some spaces which are always public and it's 24-hour access. There are other spaces which are in between that, semi-public or semi-private. Burlington Arcade is one very good example of that. You take for granted the fact that you can walk through it for most of the day, but it is gated in the evening. And we have created in the bank there, the equivalent of that, as a shortcut through the block. So on the left-hand slide there, you can see the entrance from this small pedestrian square into here, up the steps, and into a space where the organization of the bank and the community of the city come together. So it provides, in conjunction with the Gallery of Contemporary Art in Frankfurt, it combines changing exhibitions, bars, restaurants, and this urban shortcut through the block. The issue of the role of public spaces around a building and inside a building and the interaction between that building and the city is also raised by our project for the Reichstag, the new German parliament, which when the wall that divided the city and ran almost touching physically the old Reichstag was torn down and reunification took place, then there was a vote about whether a seat of parliament should remain in Bonn or move to Berlin. The vote was in favor of it moving to Berlin, and then there was a vote about whether it should be a new building or whether it should be housed in the Reichstag, and the vote was in favor of the Reichstag. And there was this great symbolic event of Christo wrapping this building, and then when it was unwrapped, demolition took place, and basically what was inside was a 1960s building, because the building had been gutted with a vengeance in the late 50s. So it was essentially not a historic building, but the organization of that building was historic, essentially horizontal. A bit like the library here, in fact. Our little project, which wonderfully has, after quite a few years, has come alive. And the principles are very similar. The library here, which is an extraordinary kind of social focus within this community, is nonetheless separated out on level. So the possibility of increasing the sense of community, communication, improving the quality of that environment, creating a better place to be, by linking those levels together with spiral ramps, allowing light to come down and so on, it's a similar philosophy within this historic shell. This is a cut through the old building to show the insertion of the new one. You'll just have to take my word for it, but basically, as this building is evolving, the way in which the public spaces, which are on the roof, and the public viewing platform, which is right at the top here, accessed by a spiral ramp, so that the public are symbolically above the politicians, who are answerable to them. All of this decided and agreed in a very intense working relationship with all of the individual politicians representing their factions, 35 of them, quite an experience in itself. The relationship of, for example, the press lobby, which is in between the main debating chamber here, the position of the public tribunes here, and all of this really being very much part of the ecology of the building itself, the way in which this building harvests energy and the way in which it consumes energy, produces energy very cleanly and efficiently. You can describe this at a number of levels. I've talked about the social dimension. It's also quite interesting historically. The building, the fabric of this building, maintains the imprints of the past, the, if you like, the obscene graffiti from the Russian occupation. It would have been far less controversial to have wiped everything clean and to have kind of sanitized it, covered everything up. But it's in that sense, it is a it is a museum of memories. It's also a gallery of contemporary art, and it also has this rather interesting ecological aspect to it, of which everything is really working together. So that lantern structure, we're here in this public space, which I've described at the base of this drawing here, the public tribunes you can see just jutting in around the edge, and then there is this great sculptural form which is deflecting natural light into the heart of the chamber. This is the press lobby here with the faction rooms behind it, and then above you can probably just glimpse that ramp which is spiraling around here. So at night, this the process of democracy, it's like a beacon, can be seen to be happening on the skyline. The energy story is quite interesting in that it consumes only renewable sources of energy. So if you consider the problems of greenhouse gases and the way that that is relating to global warming on an accelerating pace, then CO2 emission is very, very high on the list of priorities, quite aside from the finite life of fossil fuels, which is between 40 and 70 years, apart from coal. But the problem is, if you burn coal to produce electricity, there is no technology at the moment to reduce the pollution that follows from that. And it's very inefficient. If you burn coal to make electricity, then you're only getting 30% of the energy. 70% is going out in the form of pollution. Now, in this project, we burn vegetable oil, which is produced from rapeseed, sunflower seed, it could be date palm. And that, as a process, on a large scale, interestingly, absorbs carbon dioxide. So that's good news right from the start. But secondly, if you burn that in something called a cogenerator, you get 90% efficiency. So within this building, in a relatively small space, is a power station, which also provides power for the new development around it. And you can quantify that. I mean, just to give an idea, when we took this building over in 1995, and it was using power from the city utilities, from the city power station, it was depositing something like 2,400 tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. That's come right down to 440. It's shown as 7,000 on here. It's a reduction, anyway, in the order of about 96%. So it's really, again, that that endeavor, everything that I'm describing, cannot be separated out from the political process. It is right at the heart of the decision-making process. So this committee, for example, was chaired, I say was because it's coming to the end of that particular regime, by the President of Parliament, Mrs. Rita Zusmut, who is actually senior to Kohl in the ranking political German order, answerable only next to the president. And that, again, attempts to give a glimpse into the interaction within that particular group. Now, there's, in terms of the decision-making process, in other instances, the lines of communication and the decision-making process can be delegated in much simpler terms. And I really just take some extracts almost out of the project file for this scheme in Nîmes. And quite interesting for me to go back to my very first sketches, which were in July 1984. And this was, I visited Nîmes at the time that we were invited to compete for the project, along with a group of other international architects. And it was a site here for a cultural center that would be a center for the visual arts and would also be something called a Mediatek, which is an information center, works in community terms, provides all kinds of facilities for people through various aids. So it was a building that was going to work for visitors but also for the community alike. On this site, opposite, arguably the best preserved example of a Roman temple remaining, the Maison Carrée. The site was really squalid, I mean, very run down. The whole area was in a state of dereliction. And you can see even in this aerial photograph, there are parked cars everywhere. That was for a specific site here. But before even being interviewed for this project, I was moving around Nîmes on a first visit. And in my notebook, I was talking about the importance of the route, the space, the site, how you would see it, its symbolic qualities, the problems of the areas around it. And although this is a later model, this again is a sketch. July 84, that same visit, looking at the relationship of that space, the Roman temple there, to the water gardens, walking, getting a feel for it, trying to find out as much about the spirit of the place as the physical realities, experiencing the fact that at that time of the year, if you took the main route down from the sort of central part of town, you would be going through a tunnel of trees, you'd be exploding into the sunlight, and at that point already noting about the problems of cars and parking. And here you can see in the aerial photograph the building that we did finally build, having won that competition. And over many years, quite a struggle, all kinds of problems of funding, quite normal in terms of a building project, which meant that it lasted for some 7 years. This was the site for the building, is opposite here. You can see that there are no public spaces, really. It's hardly surprising it's a scene of such dereliction. There are iron railings around the Roman temple. You couldn't get in. Parked cars. And this model, which is the, if you can imagine, you're standing here in front of the Roman temple. That is the site over there. And this model is starting to suggest the possibilities of a kind of archaeological reconstruction, keeping those columns, tidying them up, where there were columns that were missing, maybe making a sort of reminder in the ground where they were, bringing back, repairing the stone paving, creating new areas for people, for seating, steps, taking away the barriers, and with the proposition that this space was too important for for cars. I'm not going to talk about the building here in detail because I think that the emphasis of this conversation and hopefully any discussion that follows is much more about about the urban public spaces. So the materials are really very traditional. It does become a very interesting, almost theatrical space, and in many ways the spaces outside that relate to the building are every bit as important, albeit this was a much later commission to go beyond. It wasn't part of the original commission for the building, but followed on. You can see the way in which the space is a venue for parties, for performances. It's helped to encourage the city to close a lot of its roads for 2 weeks every year, which is the occasion of the Feria. Nîmes is a center of bullfighting in France, this particular part of France, and again is associated with these quite interesting festivals. The social space outside finds its counterpart inside with these cascades of steps, which are actually made of a kind of rough glass, a glass that you can't see through but lets the light through. So again, it's very much about the qualities of bringing natural light in. And at the top of the building, creating terraces for cafes so that you always have this relationship between the old and the new. And again, you can see the transforming effect. The one constant here is the tree. So this is the same tree here. The cars have all been taken away. The space is opened up to the temple. And there is a whole new sort of cafe life which has taken root. And it's had a ripple effect. I noticed this when I worked as a planner. Shortly after I graduated from Yale, and I worked as a planner in New Haven, Connecticut, and I was very much involved with a lot of urban renewal projects. And there was this sort of ripple effect. If you did something in a district that had some distinction, had something which brought a new kind of dimension or life to that particular spot, then that would ripple out, and very, very tangible sort of, if you see more before and after photographs. Also, working with the various departments, the local authorities there, seeing ways in which the historic core of Nîmes could be protected and the traditional axis extended out to the airport so it would become a kind of linear urban finger that along the way would also bring in the concept of parks and public space. Curiously, missing in that particular part of France. I talked about the political dimension, and here a very European pattern, the individual, the mayor, the charismatic individual who can carry the weight of the community and who is elected on the strength of his achievements. And I talked about the struggles for funding, and when he finally got the funding, he plastered Nîmes with these posters, great posters saying, you know, audacity, it worked, we got our money, you know, we really got it out of those, you know, mean kind of characters in Paris, you know, we really got it together. And this is Jean Bousquet, who is in that mold, and therefore cannot separate the courage of an individual. And I think that it's probably true to say that any project which is successful in this field, like so many others, you can track it back to one individual, whether that individual is immersed in a committee or whatever his relationship is. It's invariably an individual with courage to take on very considerable opposition. I mean, the site was occupied at one point by some kind of rotting columns, 19th century columns, which were just about to fall down. And there was a great debate about whether these columns should remain. And there was a dining club that was set up. And that dining club would meet, and people would come together, and those who were opposing the mayor would dine under the portico in defiance of the mayor. And it was only a few years afterwards that on one occasion I went to Nîmes, and somebody came up to me and said, you're Norman Foster? And I said, yes. And they said, well, I just want to tell you that at the time of the project, I was violently opposed to everything that you were associated with. I thought it was a travesty to do that building there. And I have to tell you, I think it's fantastic. I was wrong, you know, the mayor and you and everybody else was I mean, incredible awareness, debate, and that extends right down to the furniture that goes in these spaces. And we design, amongst other things, bus shelters, urban furniture. This is really putting one of our designs to the test. This was at the time of kind of football mania in France. And somebody calculated that there's nearly 2.5 tons sitting on top of here. I thought it was an incredible achievement until the man said, but look, it's bending, you know, sort of. Interestingly, this, and I don't quite know why, it's been suggested to us that although it was designed more than 10 years ago, that it really is a kind of anonymous design. It has a sort of anonymous quality, although it obviously doesn't have a kind of retro look. And for that company, Deco, it is their best-selling bus shelter. I mean, I was 2 weeks ago in Barcelona, where they've adopted it for the whole city. And there's now a sort of big debate because they're producing 100, but there's another 1,400 bus shelters still around. And you know, why haven't they replaced them all? It doesn't have too much of a market in some parts of this country where there's a very strong preference for the sort of retro look. So Deco sell sort of historic-looking bus shelters and advertising kiosks, but that's another story. If I continue that relationship between infrastructure, design, buildings, the relationship of the buildings as political acts, the way that they can be encouraged or discouraged, that relationship to civic decision making, then perhaps one of the most best publicized examples is Frank Gehry's new museum in the city of Bilbao, which you can see on these two images here, and has received an incredible amount of publicity recently, and is very much a part of Bilbao's regeneration in that sort of area of extraordinary anarchy as a great sort of symbol of optimistic change. And without doubt, it's been an incredible catalyst. But that has really come out of an attitude in Bilbao, which we have shared over a very long period of time with the design of the metro. And it is interesting that most metros just happen. I mean, how they happen, they're probably just totally engineering dominated. And the fact that people spend so much time in them, that they become a major element in the cityscape because they erupt and they connect with these subterranean passages. Significant that must have been about 8 or 9 years ago that the city of Bilbao decided that their metro system was so special that they were going to make it the subject of an international competition. And that, again, I think speaks more loudly than anything I can say about the way that this project was realized. It is interesting that in a city which is associated in a way with that very strong sort of streak of anarchy and rebellion, that all the extraordinary amount of research that went in, that we devoted to the design of the research into making concrete graffiti proof. In other words, we were saying that when you go into an underground station, you're not in a building. I mean, the idea that you take an underground system which has this wonderful cave-like heroic quality, you really feel you're in the ground when somebody's digging a tunnel through rock, and then the idea that you might just then line that out with a false ceiling and false walls and pretend it's a space like this, is a contradiction. So idea of using, expressing that raw concrete, but then that's absorbent, and how do you counter graffiti? So all this research is totally graffiti-proof. The crazy thing is that they have so much extraordinary pride in this that a spray can has never been near the concrete. I think it says a lot about the civic pride, it says a lot about the civic leadership, the relationship between the physical spaces and the individual structures. I could give you endless examples from Europe, which are very pertinent, as I'll go on to suggest, to London. This is the city of Barcelona, and the city of Barcelona sits under this kind of mountain skyline, and erupting on the skyline were a series of illegal masts for communication. And there were three competing companies, the local television station, the national television network, and Telefonica, who each wanted a very tall mast. And so something like this was really just about to happen. And the mayor of Barcelona, Pasqual Maragall, took, again, this extraordinary, courageous initiative. You might argue it's the truly creative act that makes it possible for individuals like ourselves as architects and engineers and teams to come together to follow that through. But it was Pasqual Maragall who said, this is too important. We can see this site from the main boulevards, from the squares. It's on axis. that cannot happen. It's going to be one tower. It's going to be the subject of an international competition, and you're all going to share it. I mean, that it's very, very difficult to communicate what that means, even to myself so many years afterwards. I mean, these three companies, two of them were deadly rivals. I mean, they were stealing each other's frequencies in the air. And the idea that they came together as one board, so what they did is they decided they would sabotage the project. And so they came together. The board changed 40 times in the first year, and they made life hell. But somehow we hung on, and the building was built. The building did challenge a lot of preconceptions about what a communications tower would be. And normally, they're great sort of hulking things at the base. They're usually about 25 meters, and they're usually made of concrete. They're kind of inherited from the factory chimney. So the idea that you could question fundamentally that building form and do something that was more like a needle that would come down on this protected parkland, which was the site, and very delicately sort of guy that with almost invisible cables was really quite revolutionary to produce these platforms in the sky. So it was part sculpture, part needle. It was rooted in social concerns, it was rooted in the technology, it was rooted in a desire to do something beautiful on the horizon. Again, the mayor said, you know, this is not just a private building, this is in part a public building. It should have a viewing platform so the citizens of Barcelona can see, have a fresh perspective on their city. The same way that the Reichstag that I described offers as a public space at the upper level the opportunity for everybody in Berlin, Berliners, visitors alike, to have that new perspective, that new horizon. And here you can see that space integrated into the structure. It's quite interesting that man, Pasqual Maragall, is here at the time of the Architecture Foundation debates that were quite instrumental in leading to projects that might reshape and raise the level of debate. Pasqual Maragall is a great guy, and he jumped at the opportunity to be able to share his experience and come over here. And I don't think you can separate that from a lot of the other influences at the time that were leading to the re-examination of how a city on the scale of this city could effectively have an overview of all the competing demands. And there was a lot of media coverage of those events and a tremendous public interest in the issues of London, environmental issues, design issues, civic issues. And I think that that did play a part in the main project that I wanted to talk about this evening, which is the so-called World Squares project, which again was a competition, and competition that we won to examine this very, very large area here, which stretches from Trafalgar Square, just south of the Houses of Parliament, from Horse Guards, across to and including the embankment. The brief was to improve access for everybody, to provide a higher standard of urban design, to improve the reliability and journey time of buses, and to improve visitor appreciation of the centre. Interesting, we assumed, and this brief assumes that the dominant in this area is the visitor. And that was a false assumption. I mean, one interesting conclusion was that the dominant group in this area are actually Londoners, not the other way around. It was also to look at the setting for listed buildings. Unbelievably, this area contains 170 listed buildings. Over 30 of them are Grade 1 structures. Here you can see the client team, quite a big group, and here you can see the consultant team, the individual groups, their specialities, traffic, pedestrians. So a multi-headed client and multidisciplinary team addressing the problems. This is an extract from, as a sequence, from many presentations which have taken place on the project, essentially saying that the picture postcard of London, when you're actually down on the ground, is a different kind of reality. And I think we're all of us familiar with some of those problems. I mean, it's quite interesting that you can use design tools, you can quantify things, you can also move around and actually look at things through fresh eyes. I mean, it is extraordinary when you think about it that this side of Trafalgar Square has so many people, is so tight. I mean, it is so tight that you can see the desperate attempt of people here where they've worn the grass away by leaping up the step to try and, you know, survive. And then this great solid wall of metal that separates, and the other side of that solid wall, all this pavement, not a soul, empty. And here you see a member of the team. We nearly lost him, Peter Heath, as he tries to weave through the traffic. And here you see the tasteful decorative elements within Trafalgar Square competing with the pigeons, and really kind of empty, very desolate. And you can see the people hanging off the sort of restricted space, literally, legs dangling. Not exactly the best setting for the National Gallery. It is, I suppose, a matter of balance. And it's not a sort of radical master plan. It's really saying that at any point in time, a city, any city, is like a kind of organism. It's continually adapting to changing circumstances. Something that was essentially designed for the horse and cart, not surprisingly, doesn't survive that well with the onslaught of, in that area, something like 17,500 goods vehicles, 8,000 motorcycles, 35,000 taxis, 50,000 cars. Interestingly, 50,000 cars here are about the same number of people in terms of moving people as the 4,000 buses, 75,000 pedestrians. So it's a matter of addressing the balance, adjusting the balance between access and security, private cars and public transport, tourists and Londoners, the ceremonial against the everyday. And it's quite interesting. I mean, there are value judgments in this. I mean, at one point, somebody was saying, you know, Whitehall is a kind of dead kind of space. Maybe the Covent Gardens and the Sohos of a city are only lively because they do have the ceremonial, the Whitehalls. I mean, probably it would be an incredibly boring city that was wall-to-wall Covent Garden and Soho, or wall-to-wall Whitehall. Maybe without the ceremonial, you don't appreciate the spontaneous. So it's always that that continuous sort of polarity, the needs of people standing still from moving, local needs against London-wide needs, the old against the new, and so on. And as we start to discuss these issues, and this is a list of the groups, 180 organizations, discussions with every single one of those organizations. They start at A with the Automobile Association, end with the Whitehall Court Residents Association. An intimidating sort of array of interests, each with their own agenda. And Space Syntax, who are a very interesting group born out of an academic background, were literally monitoring the movements of 10,000 people. At one point, we've got a very interesting series of diagrams where our team followed people as they left underground stations for 10 minutes, just to see, kind of discreetly, I hasten to add, walking and seeing where they would go and whether they would turn back, how long it took them to negotiate the various sort of traffic intersections. In this case, noting that 60% of Londoners and 40% visitors, everybody was absolutely convinced, even the people who wrote the brief, that it was the other way round at the outset. As you start to observe, you can see sort of, you know, people treated in a way that you would not treat cattle. And the survey of the traffic, 9 control points, 27,000 vehicles. I mean, stopping 27,000 vehicles and giving a little piece of paper and a bit of chat and then waiting for them to come back and finding all kinds of interesting things. I mean, you know, 25% of the traffic that goes through Trafalgar Square has no business in Trafalgar Square, no business in London. It's going from one side of London to the other side. It's bypassing the M25 and all the other orbital routes that are provided for it. The chances are that those 25% are also the biggest, arguably the most hostile, aggressive Pantechnicons that have no business whatsoever to be there. There were some quite amusing little sort of incidents. All this project started when I invited a small group of people, and Ricky was one of the first people that I discussed the idea with, of coming together. This was before the competition was announced, but just as an interest in the city and some of the issues and problems, people that I'd worked with and come into contact. And so we had this little ritual of every Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock we'd meet and we'd spend an hour and we'd have sort of, you know, nice breakfast together and talk about this and that. And then the competition came along and it seemed a natural to compete for, and then we got immersed in the competition, but we still kept the Tuesday morning venue. And somebody from Space Syntax came up with this slide, kind of computer printout, not a slide. And this is Trafalgar Square. This is the National Gallery here. And it's showing people, as it were, sort of standing still. And they had this, I don't know how socially accurate this is, but they decided that anybody who was wearing a suit was working in London, and anybody who wasn't was a kind of visitor. So they're a little, you'll never see them, but there's the odd yellow spot, so there's some sort of rather forlorn worker in a suit mixed up with all these tourists. And we couldn't understand why that we expected a few kind of green lines across here. This is people, a kind of road crossing pattern where there isn't any pedestrian crossings. And we saw, well, not surprisingly, we saw this great kind of void in the middle of Trafalgar Square. And we had some ideas of why that was so, because it was very, very difficult to actually access it and cross it. Quite a proliferation of people here, not surprisingly, because that's where all the pigeons congregate. And then all these lines going to this island. We couldn't understand why they were all running out to the island. they weren't standing long enough to be logged. So they were always on, you know, they're on the move on the island, so there were no red dots on the island. And we debated this, and suddenly I remember saying, this is crazy. I mean, it's not a site in another country. You don't have to get on a train to get there. Why don't we just get in the car and drive there and have a look? And so what we did is we got ourselves on the island. Here's the team on the island. And this was quite fascinating in itself, because we never, ever visited any of these places as Londoners. You'd only do it as a tourist, and you don't ever behave as a tourist in your own city. And the reason why this kind of lemming-like flow to that traffic island, it was all about snapping the best views of London. That's where you got the picture postcard views, because these red lines here is really what the camera sees, and you get all the incredible vistas. There were other studies that we did around traffic flow, and it's actually not difficult to extend Trafalgar Square in that direction and take advantage of that. We summarised the conclusions out of all this work as a master plan, and identified key areas that we would address with proposals to adjust the balance, primarily improving the setting for buildings, improving the quality of life, facilities, ability to be able to sit down, make life a little easier, access the public spaces, bring them to life, extend pavements where it was appropriate, reduce the car where it was appropriate, improve the access for buses and taxis and cycles. There was a public exhibition, a series of public exhibitions, lots of questionnaires received and reactions noted. And the changes, some of them really quite modest. You probably have to look quite hard at this to see that in Whitehall, this ceremonial space with the cenotaph, that you can easily extend the pavements, and you can extend the space around the cenotaph, and you can calm that down. You can take away, you can make special provisions for this area in terms of signing. You could take away a lot of the kind of civic vandalism that we take for granted with single yellow lines, double yellow lines, and so on. You could also do some fairly modest things around Old Palace Yard, which is arguably not the best location for a surface car park. And when you look at all the barriers, not just one barrier, a barrier here, another barrier there, another barrier there, it's a series of iron fences. So there are other places. It's a relatively small car park, but a very, very important place. And when you think that this is a single heritage site, I mean, this has been identified worldwide as being on a par with, you know, with the pyramids, with the Taj Mahal. I mean, this is one heritage site. The fact that there's a road and all those parked cars in between it, and it's two separate entities which desperately need to be brought together, was again one of our concerns. We went into a lot of background detail, looked at the implications outwards from the site. I mean, essentially the shorthand here, I'll never be able to, this is nodal points, these are roads. Essentially, red is bad news in terms of congestion, and blue is good news, and pink is bad news. This started to assume all kinds of unintentional political overtones in some of the presentations to people like Prescott. The colour selection was not politically correct, but it made the point. And diagrams like this were quite important in terms of comparing how it is now with how it might be. I could do 500 presentations like this every night to groups and so on with journalists, and I would still open my paper and find that our proposals are about closing all the roads in central London. Just to sort of get the record straight, the yellow here is where you do extend the pavement. So the only extensive reclamation of the pedestrian domain is on the north side. And here you can see that the spaces do extend out, and we do create a new space as a sort of gateway to Trafalgar Square at the northern corner here. and the buses still flow. Buses, taxis and cycles are red, and the other vehicles are blue. So it's not that radical a change. And although there's always trade-offs, you can't do one thing without it having an implication on something else. It is a considered, analysed, balanced set of proposals. Here you can see Trafalgar Square as it is at the moment. This is the north side. You remember I showed you these images before. And so the proposal would be to extend the pavement to connect physically the National Gallery with a pavement across. Could have fountains, could have trees. Also could improve the access to Trafalgar Square, so it wouldn't be a kind of vacuous space in the middle. This is the entrance space, the new one that I talked about on the northern corner opposite the National Portrait Gallery, provide a better setting for that institution. And coming back to Trafalgar Square, as it is at the moment with the solid wall here, if you take away the buses and then you open up here, so you not only get better connections on the diagonals to encourage people to move across the space, but you also get the ability to flow easily and generously into the heart of that space, really bringing the area into a new lease of life. A similar move on Parliament Square, on the southern edge, keeping all the roads flowing there, but just extending the pavement here, taking out that portion of the road, and then allowing the ground to flow, maybe fountains, maybe more landscape, maybe the potential for an outdoor cafe. Now, yes, it is a balancing act. There is an implication in terms of traffic impact. You do get journey times which are affected by anything from 2 minutes, 1 minute, 4 minute, 10 minutes, as journeys right across from one side of London to the other, averaging something like 60 seconds over the area. But at the same time, you are creating additional pedestrian space equivalent to something like two Trafalgar Squares. The political dimension, even during this project, as a result of a spin-off from that early debate that I mentioned, Horse Guards was transformed. I remember making a plea for Horse Guards and saying I thought it was an outrage that arguably one of the greatest potential civic spaces in Europe should be one of the largest surface car parks in Europe. And you can see the transformation there. And the argument that London will come to a standstill, the roundabouts, it's not that long ago that everybody was saying doom and gloom about the roundabout outside Buckingham Palace. In actual fact, when they closed this whole area, closed it whilst it was under construction, the traffic still flowed. There are lots of interesting theories that when you close a bridge or you close a road, that the traffic does find other routes and it does not come back. But that's another line of theory. We have seen some of the transformations, for example, when Trafalgar Square was totally pedestrian at the time of Nelson Mandela's visit. We do show on the left how some of these improvements could be very easily phased. What was fascinating about the public consultation was that if you took all the responses together, more than 80% voted for change, some change. The Westminster residents, 64% of them voted for change. They were more radical, interestingly, than the consultative group. You know, that 200 in number, 52% there. And, you know, is it another report? Or does it get realized? And that, of course, comes full circle right back to the whole political structure and decision-making. In Asia, there is a different approach to decision-making. You might recall that something like 20 years ago, there was talk about maybe an international airport was too dangerous to have on the edge of a major population center. That maybe it should move out away from the center. It's interesting that debate in Hong Kong, which has no land, would create something that could be seen from a satellite, an island which is bigger than Heathrow, and which was constructed out of the sea in some through 2 years, and a building, a huge building, actually a compact building, because although this building is an overnight transfer in 6 hours from one existing airport to the other, in terms of passenger movements, it's the largest in the world, on a par with Heathrow, about 40 million international movements a year. In terms of size, under this 45-acre single roof, it is the equivalent to terminals 1, 2, 3, and 4, plus 40%. And if you compare the footprint of this, it is quite compact compared with all those other buildings added together. You get an idea of the scale by seeing that you can put Wembley Stadium into the baggage hall. That is, in a way, a public building. I mean, it has a very, very large shopping complex, and it is a major attraction with the high-speed link. It's not a building in isolation. It is a considered part of a total infrastructure with fast trains, bridges, roads. I mean, an incredible investment in the future. The kind of attitude that, in a way, I think has been learnt from what happened in this country in the 19th century. And quite interesting to make comparisons. I made a comparison with Maplin Sands, comparison with the scale of Heathrow. This is an aerial photograph of Heathrow. This is dotted line is the plan of the island, and here we see Heathrow. And I think that it must be about 5 years now that the legal process of questioning whether Terminal 5 can expand Heathrow, the public inquiry, I think it's been running for quite a few years, estimated to have cost over £100 million already. And in that space of time, in Hong Kong, they've built an entire island and a building and commissioned it and created a great development site and moved the airport away from the city and created the means to get there faster. We still have no link between London and Heathrow. I mean, it's unbelievable. It does come back to decision making. And if you really want to magnify some of these issues of population growth, of pollution, I think that everybody has a lot to learn from each other. The American model of the city, where the city center becomes an area of increasing social deprivation, as annular rings of residential development expand out from the center, consuming valuable land, creating more and more roads, more and more traffic, more pollution, more congestion, leading to the decay of the inner city. That model, I think, is highly questionable. It can be debated. But if you compare, for example, a city with a not dissimilar climate, similar population numbers, Copenhagen, for example, compact European city, and you look at the way that communication takes place, and you just look at gasoline consumption, then it's almost one-tenth of Detroit. And if we start to look at the issues of energy and the increasing size of cities, the accelerating pace of urbanization, if we look at the new mega cities, I mean, in 1939, the only block on here as the most populated urban center would be right here where we are now, which was London, which was in 1939 the most populous city. Now, virtually, the European cities are off the map. It's those Pacific Rim cities. They're huge scale. And this is an image that was taken from a helicopter on a visit last year of a suburb of Mexico City, one of those Pacific Rim accelerating cities. This conurbation is called Chalco. It's a suburb of Mexico City. It has the population of a European city. 3.5 to 4 million. Nobody knows exactly. That's the best estimate. And it has no infrastructure. So it has no hard roads. It has no drainage. It has no electricity. It has no gas, no sewage. It has no infrastructure. If you start to take the changing patterns of growth and pollution, if you start to look at carbon dioxide emission, if we're 5.9 billion at this point on this planet, and 2 billion of the 5.9 billion, 2 billion do not have access to energy except by burning wood or burning animal excrement. And then, if you say, well, at the moment, in terms of energy consumption, A typical American is producing 20 tons of carbon dioxide. A typical individual in China or India is producing 1 ton. But in the next 20 years, the population will expand by an estimated further 2 billion with increasing energy demand. So I think once you start to look at some of these wider issues and then track back, I think I think the enormity of some of the challenges ahead, defy words. So there are all kinds of reactions one could have to that. The individual that we were with, Ricardo Legoreto, a very distinguished Mexican architect, had shared some of these concerns with a very famous writer and intellectual in Mexico, who said, well, you know, all you can do is everybody has to develop a sensitive, they have to do their best in whatever their role or profession is. So in that sense, it's heartening to be able to share some of those thoughts with an audience here in this particular building, which is very different from in its makeup and in terms of its future relationship to society, interestingly and very relevantly different from the audience that I normally talk to, which are architects and architectural students. So Ricky, thank you very much.
Exactly 1 hour.
Very, very good.
Case we thought it was only going to be about architecture. I think one needs to be convinced that the activity of designing the placement of a wall or the location of a building has transcends so much more just the stylistic and the architectural act, and it was made very clear by Norman's contribution to